Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world. And welcome to Information Week Live for the week of February 15th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor for Technical Content at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We are glad that you're with us, and we are glad that you're part of the Information Week community. We have a great discussion going on right here around the radio show if you're listening live. And I also want to remind you that we are part of a community that includes the live face-to-face event called Interop. Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community, happens April 27th through May 1st, 2015 at the lovely Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information or to register, please go to www.interop.com. And now it's time for your news in 60 seconds. Tesla wants to power your home. That's right, cars aren't enough. The high-tech company wants to have the battery power that provides the juice for absolutely everything you do. Power companies are probably about as excited about this as GM is about the Tesla Motor Company. Let's hope that in all of their finding energy, Tesla can find an answer for the flashlight that always fails to work when you go to grab it from the drawer. Lenovo wants to own your browser. The Superfish malware slash adware has been found to be part of Lenovo computers sold over the past couple of years. Not content to simply serve up ads for things you don't want, this software actually keeps you from providing secure connections with the people you do want to talk to. When asked about it, Lenovo said, "Hey, it's just a computer. What do you want?" IBM wants to change your mind about millennials. According to IBM and their latest research, we find that millennials, despite what many people say about them, do use technology, don't feel entitled, don't want to hop from job to job. When contacted about this, one millennial said, "Hey, whatever," while another simply rolled his eyes. Hackers want to steal your money. Kaspersky released information on a gigantic global banking hack that stole more than $1 billion from global banks. According to information, they avoided detection by limiting their theft from any one institution to $10 million or less. It's nice to know that someone has a rounding error bigger than my lifetime earnings. And finally, Apple wants to own your wrist. With 5 million plus pre-orders, the Apple Watch is already set to become the most successful smartwatch ever. While no one is quite sure yet what it will do or why one would wear it, it can be certain that one of the first apps is likely to be a way to let you order your latte from the good folks at Starbucks. Keep your eyes peeled for the latest in fruit-flavored wristwear. Well, that's your week in 60, and now it's time to drill down into some of those stories. The first is that we're going to be talking about what's going on in the world of networking and storage with the editor-in-chief of Information Week sister site, Network Computing. Sue Fogarty joins us from the frozen Northland. Sue, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. I really enjoyed your update there. I'm not sure I can follow that up. It was very entertaining. My stories aren't nearly as funny.
Well, you get to tell us some important stuff, though, because we know that there's lots going on in the world of network and storage. What's been happening this week over at Network Computing?
Well, There's been, you know, there are a lot of interesting things going on in the news, but on the site, we've had some career content that has been doing really well and sparking a lot of great conversation that I wanted to tell you about. Early this week, one of our contributors who has been working with the site for a long, long time, his name is Lee Badman, wrote a story about Wi-Fi career resources. And Lee is the wireless architect for Syracuse University. So if you've ever been to Syracuse and been to one of their basketball games and been in that stadium, you will understand that his job is just a monster of a job to make sure that the wireless works in that stadium and across that entire campus. So he really knows what he's talking about. And he decided that you know, there are a lot of up-and-coming opportunities in Wi-Fi and that there was a need out there for just some general career advice, because he had a lot of people asking him for these basic things like, where should I look for this, where should I look for that? So he wrote just kind of an overview about the training and certification options that are available, online support communities, what you can do to build a test environment at your workplace or in your home, different conferences, including Interop, some of ours, and other options, and bloggers online that he reads, including, you know, some of our own on network computing, and other options in the online community. And our audience really responded to that, and we got some great conversation going.
You know, I'm not surprised. We tend to have great conversations around career-oriented articles pretty much wherever we publish them. But I'm curious, now, is the career path or the career details for Wi-Fi dramatically different than the career advice that you would tend to give someone in another segment of networking? Are there truly unique components to the career in the Wi-Fi area?
Well, there are different resources for them, because there are specific Wi-Fi certifications, there are specific conferences, and different companies that run all of these things. So if you aren't aware of them, then you would need specific guidance to find these. And it's, I think, depending on company size and what your company does, some IT professionals tend to really focus on Wi-Fi, while others who might work in like a medium-sized business or something, in that kind of environment, Wi-Fi is just part of your job, and then it might not be as big of a need. But there, I think companies are beginning to hire more specialists in wireless, and that's where you will see more of a need for really specialized certifications and education becoming a greater thing out there in the market.
You know, I have to say, one of the things that I have seen is that when you get into Wi-Fi, you can't avoid issues around RF. And RF takes us into the world of analog electronics, something that a lot of the people who have grown up in the computer age just aren't comfortable with, because all of a sudden it's not ones and zeros. You're talking about levels and waves rather than simple on-off states. It's a huge difference in the way you think about electronics. And so I really can't imagine that there's a steep learning curve for some people who are coming out of the computer or traditional networking world.
It is a very different thing. And I think there's a lot of trial and error involved that a lot of IT people aren't necessarily used to, depending on the environment. You know, if you're indoors or outdoors, what kind of buildings you have, the structures that are involved, and as you said, interference from other sources. So that's a learning curve that you have to overcome and get used to trying something, and then you have to go around and measure the performance, and if it's not there, you have to try something else. And that's where the lab, I think, comes into play, too. And one thing I thought was really interesting in the feedback to the article is that even very experienced professionals on the site had responses saying, wow, you know, I never thought of that, you know, or this is brand new to me, even though I've been doing this for 25 years. So there's always something new that you can learn. And when you get a group of people together and they brainstorm about things, you never know what's going to pop up. So I think we'll definitely be following up with more specific articles in all of these different areas so that we can allow for greater investigation into all of these different areas.
Well, now, I'm going to throw in one thing. I found it very useful when I've been working with Wi-Fi. I years ago became an amateur radio operator, and that's a great way to learn about the whole RF side. It's simple, easy. Can't recommend that enough to folks. But
yes.
I know that's not the only thing that you had going on over at Network Computing. We've got a couple minutes left. What else?
No, certainly. We published a slideshow about the companies that had laid off the most people in the last year. And that got quite a bit of feedback as well. And it was very, very interesting to see because in 2014, the top three companies that laid off the most employees were all tech companies. They were HP, Microsoft, and Cisco. And I was actually surprised when I saw that, you know, because the tech sector was actually, according to the report that, you know, that we were quoting, was among the stronger segments of the U.S. economy, yet a lot of these individual companies were having to reduce their workforces pretty dramatically. And in the top 10 companies that had major layoffs, five of them were tech companies. The other two were Intel and Sprint. So we did a slideshow of those. And we got some feedback was from the actual companies that were in the slideshow, and they were not all that happy to get the negative PR, but it's great that they're chiming in and giving us the background into what's going on, you know, and why it's necessary. But I think one of the things that we use data from Challenger Gray and Christmas, which is an outplacement firm, so they see a lot of job postings and data about hiring and firing and whatnot. They said that even in the companies that are actually reducing positions, some of them are creating just as many positions. So it's because the industry is in such a great deal of upheaval, and there's, you know, so much technology development going on that a company may not have the right people that it needs to create the new technology that it needs to. So it's not necessarily that things are going badly. We just need for them to go differently. So, and I also think, you know, that the trend toward doing things, you know, companies being very agile and lean and streamlined, definitely leads them to reduce people when they need to show greater earnings or, you know, some positive results to Wall Street. They tend to, shed some people because they are expensive.
Well, Sue, we have reached the end of our time together. I know you've got lots coming up in the coming week. How can people follow you and keep up with what's going to be happening at Network Computing?
They can come to the site, of course, networkcomputing.com. I am Susan Fogarty on Twitter, and Network Computing with no G on Twitter is our Twitter handle.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for being with us, and hey, we'll look forward to catching up with you again next week at this same time.
Excellent. I appreciate your time.
That was Sue Fogarty, Editor-in-Chief of Network Computing, talking about all things networking. Well, after that very interesting and happy kind of information, it's time to scare the dickens out of everyone with our regular weekly horror show from the world of InfoSec. We have, once again, Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, here to tell us all about what's happening in the world of scary computer stuff. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I'm happy to be the resident horror show.
I really feel like I should be playing some sort of, you know, Bach B minor toccata on the organ behind you when you come in, because once again, this has been a week that's been busy for data security, and not in a particularly good way.
No, I'm afraid not. There's been three really big stories this week, and all of them have to do in one way or another with spying.
Well, let's start, you know, running them down. What's the first thing that that caught your attention?
Well, on Monday, what we learned of a group called the Equation Group. That is a cyber espionage operation that's been at work, they say, since about 2001 at the latest, but we're just learning about it now. Kaspersky Lab released this research on Monday, and they are calling Equation Group the most sophisticated attack group they have ever seen. They might have been the ones who actually created the exploits used by the Stuxnet gang a few years ago. They think they might actually be in charge of Stuxnet, kind of the parent company, if you will. They have attacked tens of thousands of targets in more than 30 countries, mostly in Iran, Russia, and Pakistan, mostly going after anything you would consider critical infrastructure. So that's telecom, energy, transportation, mass media, military, government, all of the meaty stuff there. And the equipment, the technology that they have is very, very sophisticated. They have a couple of different modules that can, first of all, get at those air-gapped computers. They're the things that you specifically sequester on an isolated network so that they don't have connections out to the internet. You know, those things that you take extra care to physically put them someplace else. Well, Equation Group knows how to get into those as well. They have equipment that allows them to reprogram victims' hard drives so that when they get this sophisticated malware called Greyfish into it, they can make it go undetected by antivirus and then also persist so that even if that hard drive is reformatted or if the operating system is reinstalled, Greyfish is still there. So these are things that are not at all typical cybercrime kind of stuff. And the guys at Kaspersky and everybody else that we've asked says that this is the kind of thing that could only be done by a nation-state actor or somebody funded by a nation-state. And they don't know exactly whom that nation-state might be, but there is a strong suspicion that Equation Group is actually the NSA. So
I was going to say, doesn't Equation Group, you know, have the same relationship to our government that the United Fruit Company did back about 40 years ago, or Air America, or yet, you know, those sorts of companies that were ultimately found to be sort of thinly veiled fronts for one or another three-letter organization?
I would say that that's quite possible, although this one might have been a little bit more than thinly veiled, just because this is the first time we've ever heard of it. But the amount of technology is definitely, I mean, it's if it's not the NSA, it's a counterpart of theirs elsewhere in the world. But considering the targets, again, Iran, Russia, and Pakistan, then again, that kind of points back to U.S., although there were some U.S. targets that Equation Group has gone after. But then the thing that also really scared Kaspersky is that they say Equation Group went dark in 2014, which means that they've just gotten sneakier. They don't think that they haven't, that they've just ended their operations. They think that they've just taken it to another level of sneakiness where the malware has become maybe untraceable, or they're randomly changing timestamps. They're coming up with new ways to hide their tracks. And to Kaspersky, that is, quote, super scary. And
well,
that was
also,
Monday.
And I was going to say that interestingly enough, kind of wraps into the last story of the week, the one that was just starting to hit today that has NSA all over it, doesn't it?
Possibly, perhaps, yes. Today's news, we're just going to skip over yesterday's news, which is another thing, but today's news is via everybody's favorite whistleblower, Edward Snowden, apparently told a publication called The Intercept that U.S. and British intelligence agencies, specifically NSA and the British GCHQ, hacked into Gemalto, which is a Dutch company that makes SIM cards that go in your mobile devices, and that they hacked into them in order to steal the codes that would let them eavesdrop on mobile device communications. So, Gemalto supplies SIM cards to AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, Sprint, and hundreds of other mobile device manufacturers. And so SIM cards have encryption keys in them installed by the chip manufacturers. And that's supposed to secure the communications between your phone and the cell towers. So if somebody had those keys, they could basically eavesdrop on all of that encrypted phone and text communication that's going on. So it basically allows them to spy on everybody with a cell phone. Now, Gemalto has not confirmed that they actually had a breach. They're very unhappy right now, and they're looking into it. But at the moment, there's not any real proof that something happened. There's just, there's Edward Snowden's word for it, and I'm sure that he has plenty of documents that would point to it, but we don't have anything substantial to go on yet. So it's not surprising, but it's not a happy thought. But, the government and intelligence agencies are always going to find a way to intercept communications, and they just have to keep changing their mechanisms of doing it. So if this actually did happen, I don't think anybody should be terribly surprised by it. Not happy, but not surprised.
Well, with all of this story about, government or potential government action, a story about just good old-fashioned corporate stupidity seems almost refreshing.
I think you're talking about yesterday's news, huh?
Why, yes. The, we put a man-in-the-middle attack on all of our laptops, but it's no big deal.
Yeah, that sums it up pretty well. Basically, Lenovo, the PC manufacturer, had shipped laptops preloaded with a piece of adware called Superfish. And that's fish with an F, not with a PH, as we're so used to seeing it. That's not uncommon. Lenovo, like many other laptop manufacturers, doesn't make a whole lot of money selling laptops, so they pre-install stuff that will help them make more money. And so Superfish is one of those things that serves up targeted ads to the users, and they kick something back to Lenovo for having that access. The idea is that Superfish watches what you browse for, scans the images that are being shown in your browser, and then serves up targeted ads. So if you're looking at, vacuum cleaners, maybe they'll serve you up an ad for a vacuum cleaner somewhere else, which is already annoying, I think. But that's not really the problem. The problem is that Superfish really does hijack every SSL communication that your Lenovo laptop tries to make. So that's you know, your VPN, and that's your web session with your bank, and anything else. The way it works is when you have a piece of hardware, there are a certain number of certificates that are already installed, usually with the operating system or by the browser, and so they're always trusted. Anything that uses that certificate is trusted. Well, Superfish installs its own certificate in the computer's certificate store, and that's you know, without the okay of the operating system, without the okay of the browser. It's just a separate thing, but because it's down in that deep enough, basically anything that's signed by Superfish is trusted. And it means basically that anything that comes across this machine will get signed by a Superfish certificate, because what it does is, say you're visiting your bank and your bank is trying to establish a secure connection with you. Superfish jumps in there and they decrypt the the key sent over by your bank, and then basically start a new connection from them. So everything's being routed through Superfish, which means that you have to trust them. If somebody gives you a fishy certificate, it never tells your browser that. So, like, you know, like if you go to a website and your browser will pop up a message that says, "Hey, this site certificate is not trusted," or "This site certificate is expired. Would you like to proceed?" And gives you a chance to say, "No, please save me from this terrible thing. I need to run away." The Superfish certificate is not detected in that way, and it also doesn't seem to pass on the message. So if you go to the bank and the bank's certificate is bogus, it does not appear that Superfish actually will pass that message along. You don't get any warning in the browser. And then everything that you do is signed to the same certificate. So it's like fishy and it's sleazy and it's just really, really insecure.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? I tell you, this reminds me a great deal. A few years ago, the good folks at Sony felt so threatened by their customers that they decided that installing a rootkit as part of their digital rights management was a fine idea. They ended up being swatted fairly heavily for that. Do you think the market or a bunch of lawyers are going to swat Lenovo in a similar way?
That is a very interesting question. I mean, first of all, Sony BMG rootkit, do you realize that was 10 years ago? 10. I can't believe it's that long ago. I thought it was a lot more recent than that. But I think that this is the Lenovo Superfish thing is bad news. I think that the rootkit that Sony did was more sinister because it had all of the cloaking devices of a rootkit. You know, it installed itself, it hid itself, and then it spied on what you did and sent information about you back to Sony. And if you tried to remove it, it would actually damage your operating system. And then Sony lied about it a lot, saying, "Oh, we didn't actually... they might have collected this information, but they never sent it back to us." But of course it did. So they got themselves in trouble for lying. That rootkit was showing up all over the place. There were computers at the Department of Defense that had this rootkit on them. There was something about, I think they were averaging, they were estimating about 500,000 computers were infected. So it was very messy, and nobody really came out looking good on that because it was deliberate. But when you think about it, it was mostly just collecting information. It wasn't disrupting all attempts at secure communications that your computer would ever do. And that is what Superfish is doing. So I think that Lenovo is already getting in trouble with customers. They stopped shipping laptops installed with Superfish, and they've disabled all the existing implementations of Superfish, although you do still have to manually go in and delete the Superfish certificate from your certificate store. So that's something that users have to do for themselves. They can't, Lenovo can't actually make that happen. So I'm expecting that there will be some comeuppance for them. In the meantime, the company that owns Superfish, they're called Comodia, they got hit by a bunch of denial of service attacks today. So I'm imagining that somebody has decided at least that they are going to get their comeuppance. And we'll see what happens to Lenovo. But for now, Superfish is being stopped in no uncertain terms by the DDoSers out there.
Well, obviously someone doesn't want us talking about this because your connection is starting to go away. But before it goes away completely, can you tell folks how to follow you on the social media, keep up with you on the Tweety Pipes and other things, and know what you're going to be writing about next week?
Sure. You can find us on Twitter at Dark Reading. You can find me specifically at Sarah Peters. Next week we will be doing some stuff about payment card security measures and also about some new forensics technology that's coming out from the Department of Justice. That's going to be from Kelly Jackson Higgins. And no doubt we will be following up on all of the exciting news from this week. So keep your eyes on Dark Reading for more.
Outstanding. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks as always, Kurt.
That was Sarah Peters, Senior Editor at Dark Reading, for our weekly dose of Scare You Completely about using your computers. And for most of you who are going to continue listening to this show using an oatmeal box and an abacus, we do want to let you know that this is Information Week Live for the week of February 15th, 2015, and remind you that we are part of a larger community, including the live event Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community. Interop Las Vegas will come to you April 27th through May 1st at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center in scenic Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com. Well, we have had Sue Fogarty and Sarah Peters on before. Now it's time to talk with someone who is a less frequent guest here on Information Week Live, although we hope that will change starting today. Chris Murphy is the editor of Information Week. And Chris, first of all, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt.
Well, Chris, you're going to be talking to us about what's going on in the community here at Information Week this week. So what kinds of things have we been talking about in the community for the week of February 15th?
Well, we've been talking about millennials. Thanks to Kelly Sheridan wrote about a story that a report that IBM did that said all the reasons that you're wrong about millennials, and so you can stop your complaining about them. For the research, I thought it was really good, and it sparked a really nice conversation around it, and that is around, you know, really blowing up some of the myths that millennials are needy praise seekers. You know, the cliche of everyone needs a trophy for 32nd place. The notion that they're shameless job hoppers really challenges a lot of these ideas and leaves with the idea that what's really different about them is their lifelong use of computer technology and collaboration technology. And that's the thing that you should really pay attention to, because that is something they're going to bring into your organizations and challenge you with. So a good conversation around that story.
That does seem like a great conversation, because I have to admit that the people who did grow up using computers have a much different attitude towards technology. I mean, I am of a generation, I can remember I didn't even get to use a calculator in math class until I got to college. So it's a much different relationship with computers than a lot of the younger folks have.
Right, right. The cliche that they're bad communicators because they've texted a lot in their lives is really they're just better at communicating in two ways than you are. So than you and I are, and that collaboration technology is going to be part of the stream. So that was one article that gave some people something to think about. On the more technical front, we had a lot of discussion about containers in the data center. So containers are a hot trend in data center innovation, essentially letting companies ramp up workloads, divide servers into partition or put more workloads, I should say, on a given server, and to spin those up more quickly than they can with virtual machines. And so that there's a lot of activity around there, and Charlie Babcock wrote a number of stories about that this week, and particularly looking at security of containers. So Google, he interviewed Google about their use of containers. Now, Google uses containers extensively, as in thousands of them they spin up every second to run their search, Google search. So a couple billion containers a week they'll spin up in order to run Google search. So they have tons of experience with it. But when they run their own, when they run workloads for customers, so if you come to them and buy computing space on Google Compute Engine and their infrastructure as a service, they'll do what they describe as double bagging. So they'll use containers to quickly spin that up, but they'll put those containers within a virtual machine for their customers because of some security concerns that they have. So it's an interesting where they look at it and say, for our internal use, where we really understand our applications and the way an enterprise IT organization might really understand their organization's apps, containers without kind of the virtual machine protection might be just fine. But when they're running a workload for an individual customer, they want more separation, so they double bag it with a virtual machine.
Interesting. You know, containers seem like one of those very interesting topics where people are still getting used to the concept. I've had any number of people say, what on earth is a container really? And I know Charlie is doing a great job of explaining why they're so important and how the different companies are using them, as with this article.
We have another article that's on, this was a week or two ago that he wrote, Containers Explained. So if you search that on informationweek.com, there is a description for exactly that kind of question, because you're right, it's definitely a part of the conversation. Help me understand how it's different than a virtual machine. And so he wrote about that, and then he wrote about some competition between a couple of different providers, would-be providers of containers, Docker's, which is the clear leader in it, and CoreOS with its Rocket project. So that one just posted today. So containers were hot this week. Batteries were also hot. So we wrote about batteries and Tesla's initiative or plans to make consumer home batteries in order to, so essentially we could be part of the grid, that if we're generating electricity, if we're drawing down electricity at peak time or off-peak times, we could be a two-way participant in the grid in theory. A lot of discussion around that story, so that got people talking and thinking about the potential there.
I have to admit, I do love the idea of something disruptive happening in the world of basic residential and small business electricity. I think that's just fabulous.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It speaks to that potential to disrupt that industry, and also just how batteries today are one of the things that, you know, one of the legs in terms of our technology innovation cycle, that we've seen so much in terms of cars and what's possible in terms of cars now, and certainly that's picked up. But there's a lot of potential still ahead for for battery innovation.
Outstanding. Well, Chris, we're coming down to the end of the time of our time here. Can you quickly tell us what sort of things we should be looking forward to in the coming week?
Well, we'll have more on IT careers. We're spending a lot of energy on IT careers. We had one this week that we talked about getting out of your silo. That you, if you're in a comfortable, I'm a networking person, I'm a storage person, I'm a server person, you better give up that. So look for more energy around IT careers. We're spending a lot of time on that. So look for more of that ahead.
Outstanding. And as we ask all of our guests, how can folks keep up with you? I know you're very active on the various social networks. How can people find you there?
I'm at Murph_CJ, so MURPH_CJ on Twitter. That's the best place to find me.
Outstanding. Well, we will certainly do that. Chris, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to having you in the guest seat here in Information Week Live again very, very soon.
Thank you. Anytime, Kirk.
That was Chris Murphy, the editor here at InformationWeek.com, talking with us about what's been going on in the Information Week community for this week. Well, one of the things that you heard mentioned about the community is millennials, this whole notion of millennials. And we have the writer of that story with us next, Kelly Sheridan, associate editor here at Information Week, normally is talking with us all about Microsoft. But Kelly, you were talking with us about more than just Microsoft this week.
Yes, I am. Hi, Kirk. How's it going?
I'm afraid that you let some of the cold air from the Northeast escape down towards Florida, and I'm not happy about it. But aside from that, I've been enjoying reading your various articles this week. You've had some good ones for the week and some that have spurred some very intense discussion.
I'm glad you enjoyed them. The IBM Millennial event took place this past Wednesday downtown in New York, and I apologize for sending some of our cold air your way, but I'm sorry, we could use a lot less cold air. The focus of IBM's presentation, though, was on myths and exaggerations that usually surround the millennial generation, and experts really were focused on putting sort of a Mythbusters perspective on that and pulling out the truth surrounding millennials, just kind of to debunk the stereotypes that people normally think about them.
Okay, now one of the things for our listeners, when we talk about millennials, I think everybody has a very general concept, but at the IBM presentation, did they define what precisely a millennial is?
Well, the millennials included in this study were very focused on getting working millennials because the specific focus of the study was millennials in the workplace. So they concentrated on millennials between the ages of 21 and 34 who were employed at the time that they were surveyed.
Well, now, if you listen to some news reports, that's a fairly small sample right there. But I assume that's one of the myths that they were trying to puncture in their study.
Right. So it doesn't take into account the entire millennial generation, but it does take into account those who have graduated college and who are in the workforce, just to get their opinion on how they're considered in the workplace, how they're usually managed, and their overall preferences for career goals and things like that.
Well, now, did IBM in their report on the study have any suggestions about how best to manage millennials and how to make sure that they are making the best contribution to organizations?
Oh, absolutely. They had a lot of really interesting ideas. One of my favorite points, actually, was they busted the myth that millennials are so technology dependent that they love to learn everything online and they always want to be in front of the screen. And while the common stereotypical image of millennial is someone staring at a smartphone, they found that this was not necessarily true once you put millennials in the workplace. In surveying believe it was almost 2,000 people, they found that millennials actually don't prefer to engage in corporate training online. They don't want to be in front of a webinar. They don't want to be clicking through some kind of educational slideshow. They would much rather be learning on the job by working with a seasoned colleague or by attending a third-party conference or being in a classroom session. An overwhelming majority of millennials said that they would rather learn in person as opposed to virtually, which I thought was interesting, and I think that most people wouldn't think that when they think of the millennial generation.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. That, as you point out, goes strongly against the stereotype. Now, I've got to ask, what in all that you heard surprised you the most? Was there any stereotype that you felt was correct, but they presented information to refute that?
Well, one of the more interesting facts that I found when I was reading through their research was that millennials are actually more likely to separate their work-focused social media accounts and their personal social media accounts than older generations. You see a lot of articles online that are encouraging millennials to, oh, clean up your Facebook profile or make sure you don't post that on Twitter. But in fact, millennials are a lot more careful about that than you might think. I believe it was 7% of baby boomer generation said that they would never separate business and personal social media accounts, and 30% of millennials said that they would never separate it. So they're actually a lot more on top of that than the generations who came before them, which I thought was really interesting and kind of unexpected.
You know, I have to agree with you. This difference in the way people view their social media accounts is fascinating. It does have some interesting implications for how to reach them. Well, I know that's not the only story that you wrote this week, so I have to ask, since you tend to keep on top of things out of Redmond, was there any news on the Windows or Office front this week?
There was. Cloud was a major focus of this week when we're talking about Microsoft news. Earlier this week, before all the hype with millennials got started, Microsoft announced a couple major improvements to its Office cloud storage options. So now users have access to more options for cloud storage in Office for Apple's iOS. And different vendors can sign up to participate in the Cloud Storage Partner Program, which deals with Office Online. But basically, different third-party cloud storage providers can integrate their services into iOS Office apps so that people who use services like iCloud Drive and Box can view and edit and save their documents directly to their cloud provider within Office on their mobile devices. So it makes it a lot easier for people to access the cloud through their Office apps. And while Microsoft is working on an Android-compatible service, that's not released yet. They haven't released a timeline on that. So sit tight, Android users. Your time will come soon.
Interesting. They really are spreading their wings and looking way beyond just the Windows platform under Satya Nadella.
Exactly. And I think that's something that will help a lot more people get back into the Windows game and use Office products more, just because there are so many more people running Android and iOS. And I think Satya Nadella is really focused on getting Microsoft's products into their hands again.
Well, as we're coming down to the end of the segment, tell us what you've got on your radar screen for the coming week.
Next week, it will be a surprise, as usual. It's really hard to tell what will be coming because Microsoft is just continuing to surprise me and surprise a lot of people. Given the focus on cloud this week, I wouldn't be surprised to hear a couple more developments, especially in regards to Office, probably hearing more on the mobile front. But, hey, only time will tell.
Well, for keeping up with what you're going to surprise us with in the coming week, how can people follow you on those social media accounts that I'm sure you keep so very separate from your personal accounts?
Well, I'm very active on Twitter. You can follow me at KellySheridan22. And LinkedIn is my first and last name. And, yeah, those are really my most active social accounts.
Outstanding. Well, Kelly, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kelly Sheridan, who keeps her fingers on the pulse of both Microsoft and millennials here at Information Week. Kelly is writing about all kinds of things. Please do follow her on social media and be sure to look for her articles here at informationweek.com. Well, it's come to that part of the show when we get a different take on the news, because it's time to talk with Executive Editor Dave Wagner about the Geekend. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
All right, Kurt, thanks for having me.
All right, so you've turned your gaze towards Tinseltown this week.
True. We have the Oscars coming up this weekend, and so I took a stab. We do this annually at the Geekend, a stab of what IT lessons we can learn from Oscar-nominated movies.
All right, I can hardly wait. What kind of lessons were you able to find in the movies?
Well, I'll admit, different years are harder and easier than others. I lamented in the article that I missed the year that The Social Network was Oscar nominated. That made my life a lot easier. But we have some technologically inclined movies this year. The Imitation Game, which features Alan Turing, who is essentially the father of modern IT in many ways, is featured. So we drew some lessons about that. I think the most interesting lesson that I drew, though, was from the movie Birdman, which actually has nothing to do whatsoever with technology. I looked at Birdman very much like a CIO movie. For those who haven't seen Birdman, it's a movie about a man, an actor, who's done many years of playing big action hero characters, including a character called Birdman. And he knows that works, he knows that makes money, but he yearns to do something else. And I saw that as a similar thing to the pressures CIOs are under to continue to do the same thing that has worked, the same success over and over again, versus the reality that to succeed as a CIO, you have to innovate. And that pressure is so bad in Birdman that the hero actually, spoiler alert, shoots his own nose off. So hopefully no CIOs are going to shoot their own noses off this week.
We would like to think so. You know, it's fascinating that you mentioned that. I was reading an article in today's Wall Street Journal where they were comparing Birdman and Boyhood. And
yeah.
According to them, Birdman is a film of the head, while Boyhood is a film of the heart. And it sounds like with your drawing lessons from CIOs, you're not going to disagree about the more intellectual appeal of Birdman.
Possibly. I think, though, Birdman really is about a really heartfelt pressure. We all don't like to be locked in a box. We all want to achieve something new and different, but at the same time, we're struggling to succeed, and we know certain easy paths to success, and it takes a lot of heart to walk off that path and do something different. So
yeah,
that's why I thought there were some real leadership lessons to be drawn from that movie. There's
it's
some actually really interesting lessons about Boyhood as well.
Oh, no question. You know, I was starting to say it's fascinating that you mentioned that path, because one of the things we keep hearing about films today is that so many are based on existing comic book franchises or based around a very carefully planned toy franchise, because the people in charge of studios aren't willing to take those risks. And yet Birdman is this film that is presenting these lessons to you, really did take some risks because it's based on neither of those things.
Right. Well, there's probably a lesson in this as well. One of the things that if you look at the nominations for Best Picture, very few of them came out of the traditional studio system. Most of them are what we would call independent films. Now, what's interesting about the Hollywood right now is that there's no such thing as an independent film, really, in the truest sense, because there are distribution deals and all sorts of things worked out sometimes before the movies are even made. But a lot of these movies that are Best Picture nominations were made outside of the pressures that, say, the next Avengers movie is being made on. And there's a lesson there, too, I think, for IT folks, which is that the sort of tentpole way of looking at things, particularly vendors, you know, moving away from Microsoft or another big vendor to a smaller, you know, startup takes a lot of guts, but it often pays off in big ways. So I think looking at this, you know, you have to look at it with a special eye, but if you look for it, you can find it. Movies really are about our zeitgeist, about what we think as a society at a given moment.
Well, I've got to ask, you know, this is the kind of analysis that we have come to depend on from you. Can you give us one more lesson from the Oscars before I ask you for your Oscar predictions?
Well, I will give you two. One's going to be really quick, which is Boyhood took an amazing chance. It was filmed over 12 years with the same actors, getting them to film scenes a little bit at a time for 12 years. One of the things I think that really teaches us something about IT processes. I think we take for granted that agile IT and real-time data means that IT projects have to go really fast. I think there's something really to be learned here, particularly about big data, which right now we always think of as sort of ingesting data as the most important part about big data. One of the things we're going to learn in the next couple of years is that big data is an ongoing process, much like Boyhood, which is that you're going to have to continually re-examine your presumptions and assumptions around your data to make sure that your big data projects as they age continue to be relevant, which is something that I'm sure the director of Boyhood had to figure out, is how do I make these scenes resonate with my actors as they grow and they change, which I think is really fascinating. And then another just really quick one is there's a scene from Big Hero 6, which is nominated for Best Animated Picture, with a medical robot named Baymax. And you need to watch the video to truly understand what I'm talking about. But I just want IT people to understand, this is what people think about user experience these days. This robot is a walking, talking set of glitches. And you need to realize that the only way this resonates with an audience is if audiences think that that's exactly what the user experience is when they deal with robots, voice-activated machinery, phones, those sorts of things. So I really want user experience specialists to take a look at that scene and really gain some lessons on how crazy we most people really think technology is.
Well, I don't think there are any real limits to just how crazy a lot of folks think technology is. So that that absolutely is something to look for, especially since I have to admit I loved Big Hero 6. Well, speaking of things that I love to read the things that you write. What do you have your eyes on for the coming week?
We I'm going to write based on the same research that Kelly wrote about millennials. I'm going to write something about Gen X. One of the great things about that IBM study is that they covered people from a lot of different eras. And I was mentioning a little bit of it in the chat room. Gen X is the people that really come off as the generation that does all of the things we don't like about millennials. So I thought there were some interesting findings there. And beyond that, your guess is as good as mine, but I'm sure it's going to be really interesting.
Well, Dave, we will look forward to that voyage of discovery right alongside with you. Very quickly, how can people keep up with you on the social media to find out what you are discovering out there in the big, beautiful world?
Follow me on Twitter at GeekNDave.
That we will do. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kurt.
That was Dave Wagner, executive editor for Communities here at InformationWeek.com. We appreciate him being with us, and we appreciate you being with us. We've come to the end of another episode of Information Week Live, and we very much appreciate you spending the time with us. Now, if you enjoy spending the time with us here, you would absolutely love spending time with us face-to-face, something that you'll get a chance to do if you attend Interop Las Vegas. Interop, Connecting the IT Community, happens April 27th through May 1st, 2015, at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. The staff of Information Week will, by and large, be right there on site at Interop. We've got a lot of exciting things going on in the conference, on the radio studio stage, on video news desk stages, education stages, in conversation areas. It's going to be just an incredible community happening, and we would love it if you were there with us. If you're listening to this in an on-demand copy, we would also love it if you'd be with us on the live broadcast. That happens every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time here at InformationWeek.com. And we've got an absolutely great live discussion that happens around the radio show. Love for you to be part of that. Join us on Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern, here at Information Week Live. Well, for everyone at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you next time.